As the silent seconds dance in their eternity about me and set aflame again the fire to inspire my nimble fingers to procure the pen and awaken it in a resurrection, transforming the ink to the blood of the writer. As once again he bleeds his acquired wisdom like a light into the world.
Good morning, Carver and the Big Chill. This is Claudio Speakeasy, the literary and all else, coming at you from WCOM 103.5 FM, here in the studio with my co-host, John Paul.
It's a happy, happy day.
I think it's actually Mr. Rogers. And we've got an avant-garde musician-composer by the name of George Anzac. We've actually had him on here before. Say good morning, George.
Good morning, Carborough. How are you?
And we're going to pry
into... No, he said, say good morning, George.
You didn't say that, did you?
He didn't say that. He
doesn't talk to himself much.
That guy doesn't follow instructions worth a darn, does he?
Sorry, disobedient already.
So soon.
Such a rebel.
Anyway, we're going to analyze some music that he recently composed. He actually did... a musical accompaniment for the Rubik's Cube, or I guess accompaniment may not be the term. What would you call it?
Well, I guess it is sort of a performance art piece. Mm-hmm. It is intended to be performed along with an actual person physically solving a Rubik's Cube, which is something I learned how to do in preparation for composing the piece.
Which I happen to like very much, but it was definitely, when he first told me about it, it was a totally abstract idea. First, I had absolutely no idea how to even envision that concept, but then the music certainly made some sense, at least knowing that. If I hadn't known that, I might have just thought it was interesting music, but I think it translates pretty well when you know the subject matter and the theme that you were going for.
And when I started composing it, I definitely had no idea what it was going to sound like either. That was definitely a challenge to take something that abstract and set it to some sort of music.
And what was the project done for again?
I took a class at NC State with a guy named Rodney Washka, who specializes in computer music and art music. So our final project for the class was to create a 4 to 6 minute composition, sort of our choosing. And I decided to map a Rubik's Cube. And originally my idea was to sort of have each individual square on the cube represent a specific note. Mm-hmm. And then sort of as you go from a randomized state to a solved state, the music would become more organized. I had to take some liberty. My first attempt at it didn't really sound like anything, so I had to sort of be creative and give it sort of some musical structures that worked with the randomized or the aleatoric information that I was getting from the cube itself.
What did your music professor think on about the idea?
He really liked the idea. My first endeavor that I played for the class really was very basic and it just didn't sound musically compelling. I guess mostly the rhythmic structures were too. It was completely 4/4, eighth notes, quarter notes, whole notes. And he sort of pushed me to be more creative with it. In the end, I think that it was probably too close to classical music to really kind of fit in with that genre, but he enjoyed it very much.
So do you think that his suggestion pushed you away from where you were going originally, or actually did you come together in a more organized way as a result of it?
You know, I spent so much time, once I really got my heart into the piece, I probably spent about 30 hours composing it, and once I got the original, I mean, I guess what I did is I took the last three or four moves that you would make on the Rubik's Cube and actually started with that. They sort of started with the end and to get an idea of what I wanted the last bit to sound like, and sort of like I wanted that big final chord that would sort of close everything up and say, hey, finally all the squares are the same color on every side. And then they kind of work backwards from there. And once I got into it, I really explored some different musical territory, some different ways to express not only with the sort of the randomness of it, but I also wanted to emotionally express the frustration of sort of man versus machine theme that I wanted the piece to convey.
Which, from having heard it myself, I think it definitely goes in those directions, and then some unexplainable regions, which is probably very much the idea anyway. Do we want to listen to some of that? You want to describe the first cut?
Yeah, so the piece is in four movements. So I guess if you want, we can just listen to the movement, and then I'll sort of talk about what I did to
sounds good.
Get,
we'll take
get
it
I got.
Cut for cut. Do you have a title for the first piece?
It's just the first corner that you solve, the first three little parts that you get a little 4x4 mini cube.
So there you have it, folks. Maybe this will help you improve your game. Here we go. That sounds like the end of cut one. So
yeah.
give us some of your musical theory on that.
Well, that the beginning, the introduction, was probably the second or third part of the piece that I wrote. And really, I just wanted to set up the structure, the ideas that I was going to use in the rest of the piece, sort of a prelude to the rest of it.
And who was your pianist for this?
I actually should say I don't play piano. I definitely do not have the talent to perform the piece of this level of difficulty. A friend of mine, Sarah Almond, was my pianist. She's one of my friends, a student at NC State as well. And she did a great job, spent a lot of time working on the piece. It's a very difficult piece, and amidst all her other, I think we were in the middle of finals, obviously, and
yeah.
Final projects at the end of the fall last year working on this. And we recorded it on a Steinway Grand with a KSM 32. Nice. I had sort of placed probably about 10 feet away to kind of get the full acoustic sense of being in a room, sort of just listening to this.
Where was it recorded?
I can't say where it was recorded.
Oh, I see. Yes, I understand.
It was a top secret recording, commando
style. I've been to that cave.
Yes, indeed.
Good. So the other pieces we're about to hear, what direction are they going in?
The second movement is one of the ones I like the most. It's an arabesque. This one is one of the ones that I distinctly wanted a rhythmic and harmonic mood to create for it. So it's based on the harmonic minor, or the sort of the Spanish or arabesque style chord structure. And this is basically just solving the next couple corners, but because there's a distinct structure of three different notes that I'm gravitating towards, I decided to use a structure that would allow me to sort of like, here's one thing I'm working on now, here's the next thing I'm working on, because I wanted to give it a sense of the mental structures that are going on in one's mind while you're actually trying to solve this Rubik's Cube, and it really kind of reflects that, and sort of in this way, this is also the easiest part of the cube to solve, because the structure is there and you just sort of find the squares and put them in the right spot. It's not very difficult, so I wanted to give a sort of sense of ease and calm to it.
Good.
There you go.
Well, I just want John Paul to be aware of that. We're gonna dig into your brain a little afterwards with your composer musician background to see where all this salt in the veins takes you.
That'll be a really deep hole with very little in it.
Oh no! So we're going for slice two of this pie.
All right, here we go with slice two
of the Rubik's Cube.
Thank you.
And that sounds like part two, which you called Arabesque.
Yes, yes, Arabesque, the Arabesque Adagio. I think that was the one that throws people off because it doesn't sound random. The notes are chosen specifically out of the harmonic minor scale. I put the notes in the exact order that the Rubik's Cube that I mapped them in. It just kind of came out very fortuitously, sounding like something that you might hear in a ballet or something. Mm-hmm. They're definitely rhythmically. I did have a little bit of the arabesque from the Nutcracker in my mind.
You can almost sense a dance in listening to it.
You know, and those
a
rhythm,
dark dance.
Those rhythm, the rhythm, the rhythmic structure is. I mean, I put that in there, but it's so basic. I couldn't take credit for actually composing that.
Do you want to lead us into the next piece?
The next one is the longest one. It's the Allegro. Which was definitely the most difficult musically to play, which sort of surprised me because it's pretty straightforward as far as it doesn't have a lot of dissonant structures in it. But it's fast and has a little bit of tricky rhythms in it. It's in three parts, the idea is that, first of all, you have to sort of, in this method I used to solve the cube, you sort of write the cube into an orientation that's going to allow you to solve the rest of it. And then it goes through a little bit of manipulating the third corner and the fourth corner. I want to say that Sarah did a really good job working on this, but it just the speed of what I composed and the amount of time we had, we didn't have a chance to get a take that I was really happy with. So if there are a little bit of musical flubs in there, then that's the thing that I came to realize as we were recording the piece is that it ended up being man versus machine, in that I'm just throwing this piece of composition at a pianist and saying, hey, play this. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how difficult that's going to be, and in fact that struggle I embraced as part of the overall theme that I was working for. So And at this point, I consider it to be a final product, even with the minor imperfections, which I think...
final product, but in some ways still a work in progress as far as really laying it out the way you want to hear it?
I definitely believe that the imperfections add to the beauty of the piece overall.
Ah, okay then. So. Well, then you do salute the lady.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So we'll go for the next slice. This is?
Allegro.
Allegro. Thank you. Et voila. That's that cut. So then, in closing, lead us into the final cut with title and all.
The final cut is finale. It is the part of the Rubik's Cube you get to at a certain point, and this is the most people are able to solve it up to the stage that I managed to get to in this part of the piece. And you kind of see that I brought you to is the classical music is recognizable, the forms are recognizable, the music is something that people are sort of, your ear is used to hearing. Whereas when you get to the final stage of the Rubik's Cube, most people get stuck because you have to use a series of special operations that I had to look up on the internet. I just couldn't get past these final series of moves that are very specific and basically allow yourself to isolate specific parts of specific corners and rotate them and arrange them in ways that if you didn't get very scientific or use some sort of advanced matrix algebra, I don't know how anyone would solve them. My uncle, who is an artist in up in New York, he's a graphic artist, and he managed to solve one back in the 1980s before there was an internet on his own, and he has I can't imagine how many countless hours he must have spent to discover these special operations on his own and then use them. But musically, what I tried to convey was that the music is sort of randomized sounding because I want to convey that I don't really understand what the structures are underneath what I'm doing these special operations, and musically I don't want to give any idea that there's a specific structure underlying. I mean, the structures are there, but they're very concealed, and what I did was I basically mapped each side, you know, red, blue, green, etc., to a specific key on the whole tone scale, which ends up, I guess, being let's see, A, B, C sharp, D sharp, F, G, and then I took, and those are all major chords, and then each corner end up sort of being a different sort of set of chord structures, and I was very exacting in manipulating those to be exactly the chords that were represented in the piece, and then I just chose rhythms that allowed me to convey however much of that particular state at each point was represented. Although the beginning of this, I have to admit, this was the last of it that I composed, and actually the one I liked the best, I just sort of had a system of saying, okay, if there's a white square here, I'm going to drop it a half note and change the rhythm to a triplet in a certain section, and just sort of very arbitrary and random, and actually really turned out really well.
Do you feel like it was actually a resolve, the closing piece, as far as coming to a conclusion with the cube, or is it still sort of left somewhat random and open?
The cube I want to emphasize that this entire piece is mapped, so each move, each two measures is a single turn of the Rubik's Cube, and I guess it takes me about 80 turns to solve the whole thing. And yeah, I solved it at the end.
So it is a resolve.
I guess the listener can decide for themselves if the music resolves to their satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go for it. And this is called?
This is Finale.
Finale. And there we have it. That was the Rubik's Cube by George Anzac.
And I should say that the working title for the piece is Ernio's Puzzle, after the name of the inventor of the Rubik's Cube, Ernio Rubik's.
So, ah, I see. Okay. Yeah, and since we've kept it edgy all morning, figured we'd lean on over in the direction of the Unmedia with John Paul, if he's got anything edgy to convey, or at least give us an idea of what direction we'll be going in with concerns political.
Well, I don't know if what I've got is as edgy as the Rubik's Cube.
Any comment music? on that selection of music?
Well, I liked it. I thought it was really nice. You know, even when you're doing aleatoric music, you can't avoid some organization. I mean, randomization produces order anyway. So there's no way you can ever have something that's truly random. Mathematicians will tell you that. There's no such thing as true randomness in any situation.
What do they know?
So, well, they do the math. That's far beyond me, but that's what they say. I liked the contrapuntal part of the Allegro. I thought that was very nice, and I liked the way it moved from the chordal and melodic to the...
Explain that word, contrapuntal.
Two parts moving independently.
Ah, all right.
Sort of complementary.
Not words
sort of,
I use.
Sort of
day,
like
so.
A Bach two-part invention, you know, that sections of it, which I thought were real nice. And I like the chordal parts of it. Remind me somewhat of Hansen chord formulas, which are, you know, there's a system of chord formulas that Hansen produced that produce greater and lesser tensions. And it's kind of a natural thing for people to do that. You don't have to actually know anything about Hansen to do it. So I thought that worked out really well. I think it came off pretty well. Quite well. Yeah.
I do have a little story about when I first performed this piece as a part of the final project in class. I actually brought in the Rubik's Cube and played the piece of music, and knowing that, I mean, I can solve a Rubik's Cube in about 2 minutes, so I had 6 minutes to solve it. I was like, oh, I got plenty of time, so I just kind of...
So you provided the choreography.
Right. I start turning the thing, and I'm all good to go, and I'm going slow, trying to be dramatic, like, oh, I'm not going to make it. Oh, can I figure this out? You know, and then right before I got to the final move, I get to the special operations part, and I guess I probably had about 2 minutes left on the piece, and I had to screw it up. I made the wrong turn somewhere, and then realized that I had messed it up, and I couldn't go back, and I actually had to. You have to revert all the way back to basically step two to start solving it, and then. The first thought I had was like, oh, man, I don't know if I'm going to have time to do this. And I actually had to rush incredibly fast through the last few bits of the piece. I was really sweating it because I didn't think I'd get it done in time for the class. Goodness. But I was like, you know, it kind of defeats the purpose if I don't get it solved in the end.
Right.
And I actually basically did about the last 20 moves in the last, you know, actually in that last series of chords in the outro, about 10 seconds that I had to just, I mean, I was...
So your confidence almost got in the way.
I really, really scared myself, when I'm sure it was very dramatic for the rest of the class. They really got a kick out of that.
Good.
I don't think they realized that they thought it was just part of the show.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I was definitely sweating it.
Things the audience never knows.
Yeah, I think it might have been interesting to have a mic on the Rubik's Cube while you're playing the music and having the solution worked at the same. You know, you'd hear the clicking and the manipulation. It might be interesting.
Certainly a new idea, a subject matter I hadn't considered, putting music to something we all relate to. I think everyone's tried their hand at it. I can't say I've pulled it off yet, but... I may have to try again now.
It was great fun. The whole learning how to solve it and writing the piece of music, really, I got a big kick out of it. And I'm glad that some of those structures, I think, as you said about Hansen's chord structure, I have absolutely know nothing about, I have to confess. I think the Rubik's Cube really lends itself to that, because as you are performing these special operations, you are... In a way, you start from a semi-ordered state, and then you're disorganizing them. And I definitely set the chord structures up so that they would become disorganized and more dissonant, and sort of move back and forth, as which is really what the cube is actually doing. And during those last steps, is it's sort of you're shuffling it back up a little bit, and then unshuffling it a little bit, just to get those last few pieces in the right spots.
Yeah.
Well, George, you brought a friend along with you. Why not introduce her?
I don't think she wants to talk.
I know. She doesn't have to talk.
She's radio shy. My friend, Miss Jane Anderson, has accompanied me for moral support.
Welcome aboard.
She's a graduate of NC State, as I am not. I'm a statistics major, but I still got a couple classes to wrap up.
Still a statistic.
Yeah.
All in good time.
Which actually was funny. You said, you can't really create something that's truly random, and I have to admit that I think that's one of the reasons that I have had difficulties sticking with statistics is they're all about understanding randomness, and that's just something I don't believe in the first place. So.
Yeah. Sort of a paradox, really, the whole concept.
Absolutely.
So, Jean-Paul, over to you with the Unmedia. Any direction we're steering it in today?
Well, the Unmedia today, I'm going to combine a couple of things. The first thing is that one of the things that has been difficult for people in the 9/11 truth movement is getting any attention from any mainstream or recognized media, including the scientific journals. And finally, there's been a breakthrough of the sort where one of the physicists who has been investigating and doing research and writing papers and books on the subject of 9/11 has had a paper accepted in the Open Civil Engineering Journal. And it's been published.
How recent?
Just this month.
Interesting.
Yes. And his paper is called The 14 Points of Agreement with Official Government Reports on the World Trade Center Destruction. What he does is he goes through 14 points in the 9/11 Commission report and explains how it is that he agrees with these points, and then continues to explain how those points support his hypothesis of what happened on 9/11 to those buildings.
And what is that?
That they were brought down by controlled demolition.
Which definitely seems obvious when you look at the footage.
It's so obvious if you don't have an agenda to the contrary already in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the very idea that those buildings could come down symmetrically, as they did, with asymmetrical damage, is just beyond belief. There's just no possibility, even in the random universe, that such a thing can happen. It just is not possible.
Strange that most of them didn't wipe out the entire block they were sitting on.
Right. So what Stephen Jones has done is write this paper, submit it for publication to this peer-reviewed journal, the Open Civil Engineering Journal. And they accepted it, and they published it. And so I thought I would go over a few of the points in his paper and also explain something about what we call, those of us in the truth movement, call gatekeepers. These are people who are ostensibly left-leaning or liberal thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
Who actually are gatekeepers for the truth movement. That is to say, they use their position to deny access to media and to suppress information about what truly happened on 9/11. And I've been corresponding with one of these people for several years now.
That being?
Noam Chomsky.
Quite famous.
And in my conversations with Noam Chomsky, I have continuously presented him with information from highly credentialed experts, scholars, scientists, engineers, architects, eyewitnesses, just lots of different... He steadfastly refuses to even acknowledge that these people have something to say. In fact, I'm not even sure that he's actually read the stuff that I sent him. But he always comes back to me with, well, if these people were really serious, they would have already submitted this information to some sort of publication. It would be in the press. It would have already been published by some reputable journal. And since it hasn't, I can't take it seriously.
And a press that selects the media it wants to put out in the public.
Right. And I explained to him, of course, that if you don't understand already that these publications are under pressure to not accept these kinds of materials, then the only explanation for that that I can tell is that you just don't want to know it. and you're basically turning a blind eye toward this information. Well, I finally, in this last go-round, once this paper had been accepted for this journal and published, and I wrote to Chomsky and I said, you know, here it is. This is a peer-reviewed journal. It's got a good reputation. He comes, he writes, he does two things. He writes back to me and says, well, I don't have the expertise, he's talking about himself, I don't have the expertise to judge whether this paper is meaningful or not. I don't have a set of data, of information to determine whether or not this is verifiable. And then in the next sentence he says, and I've never heard of this journal. Okay, so if he's not, if he has no expertise in the field, it would not be unusual that he would not know of this journal.
Yeah.
But still, he uses that as a rationalization for his rejection of even considering the importance of the paper. Now, what the paper talks about are very, very, most of it anyway, are very, very simple concepts. The simple laws of motion, the conservation of energy, the concept of the momentum of energy and movement.
Well, let's not go too complicated here. Go ahead.
Well, it's not complicated. It's like if you drop something off the building, it falls down and hits the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If something gets in its way, it may not make it to the ground. It may be stopped by something that gets in its way. You know,
and you're driving in the area of detonation, so let's go.
Well, ahead. What Jones has done is take these points and he's turned them into an argument that shows that basically that the official story is bunk.
Mm-hmm. And do we have footage of him or?
No, we don't have footage of him. I have the text.
Oh, I see. All right.
All right, and I'm just going to go through one or two of the more important points. In the discussion section of the paper on the WTC-7 collapse, at Building 7, which collapsed at 5:20, approximately 5:20 in the evening on the day of 9/11.
And this was a good distance away from the Twin Towers themselves.
This was a ways, was not hit by a plane, had some asymmetrical damage from falling debris from the other, from
and
the towers.
And tell us again what this building contained. I think that's
this,
an important
this
point.
Building was the building where the moron Giuliani had decided to put his emergency response center, okay, in the very complex that was already bombed in 1993. He decides he's going to put the emergency response center in there.
And, okay.
And he put it on the 23rd floor.
And there were also government documents, court situations.
The FBI had offices there, the SEC, the CIA, just endless numbers of very, very important government agencies that what they were storing there were documents, papers, files on cases that were ongoing, like...
To include Enron.
Including the Enron case. They were still working on that, and they had all the stuff stored there. It was very convenient that that building got totally destroyed, because now that information is gone. It's lost forever. So, the section reads, number one, the WT-7 collapse issue, FEMA, the specifics of the fires in WT-7 and how they caused the building to collapse remain unknown at this time. Although the total diesel fuel on the premise contained massive potential energy, the best hypothesis has only a low probability of occurrence. Further research, investigation, and analysis are needed to resolve this issue. That is a direct quote from FEMA. Okay, they say that the hypothesis that they're putting forward has only a low probability of occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
So why did they even put that proposition forward? I don't know. So Jones comments, FEMA analyzed the remarkable collapse of WT-7, the 47-story skyscraper, that even though it was not hit by a plane, collapsed about seven hours after the second tower collapsed. We certainly agree that FEMA's best fire-based hypothesis has only a low probability of occurrence. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, final report on WTC-7 has been long delayed and is eagerly awaited. Apparently, it is difficult to fully explain the complete and rapid collapse of the WTC-7 with a fire-based hypothesis alone. So, you see what Jones is doing here is he is saying, here are the points of agreement. Now let's go logically from those points of agreement to the next step. And he's saying, since FEMA has said that the buildings, it's very unlikely that Building 7 came down because of fire, you should be going on to the next step and investigate why it came down. Do real critical analysis. And they haven't done that.
Which is not being done.
Right. Yeah. So, but they did answer, you know, to some extent that, yes, Jones is right. It's very unlikely that Building 7 collapsed due to fire. Two, withstanding jet impact. The WTC towers, according to FEMA, had been designed to withstand the accidental impact of a Boeing 707 seeking to land at a nearby airport. NIST says both WTC 1 and 2 were stable after the aircraft impact, standing for 102 minutes and 56 minutes, respectively. The global analysis with structural impact damage showed that both towers had considerable reserve capacity. Jones says, yes, we agree, as do previously published reports. The 110-story towers of the World Trade Center were designed to withstand as a whole the forces caused by a horizontal impact of a large commercial aircraft. So why did a total collapse occur? All right. John Skilling, a leading structural engineer for the WCT Towers, was interviewed in 93, just after a bomb in a truck went off in the North Tower. We looked at every possible thing we could think of that could happen to the building, even to the extent of an airplane hitting the side, said John Skilling, head structural engineer. Concerned because of a case where an airplane hit the Empire State Building, which did not collapse, Skilling's people did an analysis that showed the towers would withstand the impact of a Boeing 707. Our analysis indicated the biggest problem would be the fact that the fuel from the airplane would dump into the building. There would be a horrendous fire. A lot of people would be killed, he said. The building structure would still be there.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the structural engineers involved in building the tower.
Well, they're commonly designed to withhold, to withstand that kind of pressure.
Well, and I've done some other research on this, and I've found that they actually designed, this element of design included the speed of the aircraft being as high as 600 miles an hour.
Hmm.
So all this baloney about airplanes causing the tires to collapse and fires causing them to collapse is complete drivel.
I think that's believed less and
transparent
less.
Transparent lies. Okay.
Let's take this to a wrap. I think we've dug enough into this soup.
Two of the points. Now, people can go Google this by just Googling I'm looking for the name of the
journal.
What's
the name of that website?
14 points of agreement with official government reports on the World Trade Center destruction. If you Google 14 points of agreement, you'll probably get it.
Okay.
And there's many more things in there. If you go into it, you can. Most people will be able to understand this. It's not that difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. There's a few things in there that get a little technical.
And the whole idea behind John Paul's on media is just to get people to explore these things for themselves.
Yeah, I want people to learn this stuff for themselves.
Since we don't have our wonderful authorities out there looking into the matter, it's certainly something we as a public should be aware of.
Right. Now, I want to just call attention to one more thing. Air America Radio has finally decided that they're going to let people talk about 9/11 truth. Last week, they did two shows. Stephen Jones, the author of this paper, along with others, he's not the only author, and David Ray Griffin, one of the main point men in the 9/11 truth movement, were both on the air, and they were allowed fairly good access to just say what they wanted to say. There was a little difficulty with it. The main problem with Air America is they have so many commercials mm-hmm. that once you get a thought going, you're interrupted before you can really get it all out. So it's chopped up into, you know, it becomes somewhat unrecognizable. But at least they did allow people. Then they had a guy from the government side on who was just a complete and utter dork. I mean, he made no sense whatsoever. He didn't even know what thermite was.
Oh,
so he claims that he's an explosive expert, and he didn't even know about nano thermite, which is also called super thermite, which is much more explosive than regular thermite is. Regular thermite just basically gets extremely hot really fast. You know, the other stuff blows up, produces 2.5 million pounds
And you're basically pointing toward things that that were found in the structures that came down.
Right. So anyway, people want to really learn something about this stuff, Google Stephen Jones, Google 9/11 Truth.
And there's
reading.
Also the new documentary. What's that? Something about 9/11 Truth. There's a new documentary just got put out. My favorite is still Loose Change, second edition, which you can
pursue. That's a good film. Another one is called 9/11 Mysteries, which is not new.
That's it.
It's about the same age as Final Cut.
And a lot of these contain footage that just people on the street took.
Right, and a lot of it is actually eyewitness accounts of explosions that you'd never have seen
from the bottom up
on the regular media. And one of those, like there's over 138 people that they interviewed on tape that talk about explosions in the buildings, both before and after the plane hit. The plane hit.
Well, enough of this depressing matter.
Off we go.
So much for the end media.
There you go.
Let's go back to something musical. Yeah, these are certainly things to consider because I don't think we should allow ourselves to be spoon-fed by our government anymore. We've certainly seen through Katrina and many other atrocities just how incapable they actually are. So I don't think we should take anything for granted when we hear it from them. Certainly worth exploring. We have the media at our fingertips by going on computer, by going online, by researching things. If we have any questions about them, it's amazing how many answers can be arrived at just by doing that little. And since we're spending so much time on computer, why not?
And the reason you don't want to believe these people is because they're liars.
Yes.
Okay. Hello.
I just want to point out there's like some black helicopters that I just saw kind of floating around.
That's
the
okay. I'm getting used to them. They're over my house all the time.
Are they angling any missiles towards us at this point?
Yeah, some suspicious looking guys.
Any Pentagon missiles?
Yeah. Oh, that's coming, by the way.
Well, since we've gone edgy, I promised George I'd include a little something of my own for his consideration. It's something he's going to take off the archive and put a little music of his own to. We'll see what composition comes out of this. But before I go in that direction, I do want to mention this thing on the behalf of WCOM 103.5 FM. We now have opportunities for local businesses to underwrite a show on Carborough Chapel Hill's all-volunteer, listener-supported community radio station. Because there is no commercial clutter, your message will always stand out. To find out more, email at underwriting@communityradio.coop or leave a message at 919-929-9601. And just want to let you folks know, we always appreciate your support. I can also add that starting July, the Carolina Theatre has become an underwriter of my show, The Speakeasy. And I'm very pleased to announce that, and hopefully we'll pull in some more theatrical and artistic venues out there. Anyway, going back to the edgy subject matter, last year, Daddy-O and I went to perform in Cape May, New Jersey, did Seafarers on that stage at the Chalfont Hotel, and while there I read Kurt Vonnegut's last book, Man Without a Country, which was his... In a very strange way, his closing statement, and it was very, very, very condemning toward the government, particularly the Bush government. And after reading the book, I just felt I wanted to make a statement of my own. I've been moved by many of his writings. He was a German-born American. I am a German in America. That's sort of how I've always analyzed it. And I just wanted to have my own statement, and in putting this piece together, I wrote a tribute for him called Auf Wiedersehen, Kurt Vonnegut, which some of you may have heard last week when I had Demost, the rapper, on, but thought we'd plug it again. This is Auf Wiedersehen, Kurt Vonnegut, and my whole idea in paying tribute to him was to do it in his own style, to sort of mimic his own standard of writing and sort of follow a rhythm in my own work that I felt embodies him, as well as using titles and works of his own as part of the point I'm making. I give you Auf Wiedersehen, Kurt Vonnegut. A zeitgeist, if there ever was one, of the atrocities of war. A German-born American on a dark, declining shore. You were a man without a country before you'd sailed your tide, though your literary legacies may evoke a certain stride. With your silences now broken, and your readership true, may this summon to action all that's well overdue. You weren't afraid to tell the truth, you were not afraid to speak, to these United States of complacency that have left us dire and weak. All our daily propaganda, serving only economy concerns, leaves the truth to be desired, while the grand deception churns. Even in the face of devastations, while we're dangling on a rope, we are governed by the politics of the incessant fearful scope. We're alive amid an era in which the corporate forests burn, and where nature and her children validate zero concern. While the world chokes on pollution, we are cutting nature's lungs for the greedy bottom dollar on the ladder of ambition's rungs. Could we be any more stupid by our governmental flaws in permitting new bureaucracies to violate our laws? An animal's life is a condemnation to the murderous sins of man. May we not forget God's eyes upon us and the actions by which we are damned. The way of the church has become the way of the mouse, a cultivation of doom in a sadly ornate house. Where our shepherds and bishop are all counting the take, as a graveyard of churches continue claiming their stake. We teach our children not to steal, nor to lie or to provoke, while the ones we choose to lead us are an obscene mocking joke. Gangsters rule the country with an ever-darkening plight, and we're fading with the twilight from the middle, left, and right. In his war with Adolf Nixon, John Lennon questioned those in charge and wondered why the lunatics so often steer the barge. So long, Mr. Vonnegut. We'll miss you while you're gone. A man without a country is now our collective song. In this pilgrimage of fear that governs by the blood of immoral wars, we are but subject to an ancient coven and instrumental to its flaws. America's going tribal to a party to belong. The United States of rhetoric are coming on too strong. Auf Wiedersehen, Kurt Vonnegut. We truly enjoyed your stay. It seems Slaughterhouse-Five is in the makings of a strange new day. And your breakfast of champions, no longer in the home of the brave, bids welcome to the monkey house, from cat's cradle to the grave. The lunatics are at the helm of self-serving bloody toils, where couch potatoes click remotes to keep distant from the spoils. Our children are mere cannon fodder to democracies imposed, and we send them less than willingly when the truth becomes exposed. The Patriot Act is a dance among devils to the power of the fooled, and blood is going to burn white hot until the oil-soaked region's cooled. Bushwhacked Americana has fallen from her grace and is shelved among procurements where old Satan sees his face. And that's my comment on that. Auf Wiedersehen, Kurt Vonnegut.
Here. Excellent.
Just a summation that was very much inspired by his latest book, by his last book, entitled A Man Without a Country, Our Collective Song. So anyway, that's
off
pretty much
go.
Where I wanted to go with that.
Well, that was almost unmedia.
Yes, and
a good bridge between art and conspiracy, I suppose.
There we go. Somehow just, well, art and look, it's sort of art and look out the window, isn't it? In a very real sense. Shall we break this up with a little music? How about putting on one of the pieces that you and I composed?
Which one?
Why don't you take it out and I'll take a look at the cuts. Tell you what, let's do this one. Since we're on an edgy theme anyway, the first one, Blue Whirlwind. And we'll continue this.
What's the background for this piece?
This is the Katrina.
It's one of my favorites, absolutely.
Thank you. This is performed accompaniment of the first one, Blue Whirlwind, to the accompaniment of Jim Beckwith. The first cut is actually called Mud in Your Eye. Mud in Your Eye. I've been keeping abreast of the storm's raging quest from a bar in the French Quarter of town, while the gales from the west were all doing their best to hail the apocalyptic Katrina aground. Now there's mud in the eye of the sailor tonight, where broken levees have leveled the shore. And with the warnings all out and the natives in flight, the Big Easy ain't easy no more. When the waters rose as high as an elephant's eye, and knives of wind ceased their cutting about, an eerie silence would sigh as the night gave a cry to the voodoo of time running out. All the souls in despair who felt abandoned by care, and whom misfortune did not allow to depart, questioned country and state in this quagmire of fate, and found at best a debatable heart. A generosity grew from much more than a few who accomplished what politicians could not. But before this was true, an unrest would ensue among the ravaged whom time had forgot. A dead body neglect from the governing sect is the talk of all our daily news. With rivers as streets and all disquieting feats, New Orleans is neck deep in her blues. It's a primitive take when your town is a lake, not to mention the neighboring states. There are strange things afloat in a hat and a coat, all abandoned to partisan traits. At Johnny White's on Bourbon Street, we drank warm beer and spooned canned meat, while Lake Pontchartrain cut a brand new loop and turned a cultural gumbo into toxic soup. It was helter-skelter in a stadium for shelter, where Americans were called refugees. They arrived in great number from a wind that drew thunder and took comfort where there was no aim to please. With a sailboat for a penthouse that drowned out the church mouse, the hurricane blew in some very sad ends. We paid for our choices with ever-weakening voices, resting far too easy on political trends. A government of the rich is a cancerous itch, and reminder that we have all sinned. Like Bob Dylan would say with his nomadic sway, the answer is blowing in the wind. A president touting religion as a special interest stool pigeon may be facing a rising of tides. Ceasing arrogance not, he may soon face his lot, in whom true power and justice resides. Chaos and creation, known as civilization, are subject to a shifting imbalance ashore. A maligned collective neglect always leads to regret. And the Big Easy ain't easy. That was with the wonderful accompaniment of the artist, jazz artist, Jim Beckwith, who is actually local out of Chapel Hill, although he's been all over the place. He's just come out with a new album, something, musical accompaniment for yoga. He's very influenced by the East Indian musical cultures as well. Again, to Jim Beckwith, and that was Mud in Your Eye. I wrote right around the time of Hurricane Katrina, and I wrote it as a means for the public not to forget, as much as our government, I think, would like us to. And that was the idea behind that. And I think we're starting to bring things to a wrap here at the Speakeasy. But in closing, we want to sort of touch on a few more notes, a few more harsh notes,
before
we fade out on the Speakeasy today.
George had some thoughts and questions. Let's hear what we're talking about.
I've been digesting this. I guess as you probably recall from the show we did last year, and the song that I wrote was really a response to 9/11. And I guess I kind of wanted to, you know, conspiracies never sit well with anyone. Yeah. And as sort of we digest the things that happened, in the past, you know, I mean, there's, you know, you go through history and there's all kinds of unexplained events.
Well, before you go on, let me just say one thing real quickly. What the government tells you happened is a conspiracy theory.
Right.
The government has a conspiracy theory. So we shouldn't just diss conspiracy theories.
And that's what I'm saying, is that in any event that we have in history that is not fully explained, any theory that you have about it is a conspiracy, whether it's the government's lie or which is the thing that's most obvious to me is that whatever the government says is probably not going to be the way it really happened. It's going to be some sort of self-serving story that they fabricate in order to cover their own asses. I mean,
yeah, it needs to be investigated.
That's right. And there's a book out that says, that's title of which is All Governments Lie.
So, they do, absolutely.
They do.
And but the difficulty that I think that the average person has with examining these sort of events is that it's really impossible to really ever sort of dig down exactly what happened, you know, and in a way it's hard to accept that we may never know the full truth about what happened on 9/11. But the thing that I think is important to remember is that it isn't this candy-coated story that we've been fed. There were some players at hand, and I guess the comment that I was making is that whether or not, you know, from Bush down, this was an absolutely planned event that they'd been working on for years, or if they were just opportunistic, and when certain cars started to fall, they decided, hey, let's go ahead and blow the whole thing and save ourselves, you know, a few billions of dollars. I know that those buildings had recently been insured for a large portion of money.
Mm-hmm. Just weeks before.
You know, and
millionaires became billionaires as a result.
And they were specifically insured for terrorism.
So, mm-hmm. And I'm not one to believe in coincidences.
Within weeks.
I think the big question that lingers as we sort of try to, you know, put this, the past is behind us, and I think that it's important on the one hand to examine the truth, and on the other hand to accept that we'll never fully understand it. And where do we put ourselves? Where do we put ourselves as a culture in understanding these things like the Kennedy assassination, which happened, you know, long before my time, that still sort of exists.
Which we still don't know the truth about.
And exists in my cultural mentality. I mean, I was brought up never believing that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole, you know, lone gunman, you know, from the book depository. It just never made sense to me. And I think that the legacy of 9/11 and the truths that we're going to pass on to the next generation are the important things that, you know, we don't bog them down in the details of, you know, who was where, when, but that this tragedy was something that was not only avoidable, it could have been anticipated, but that the power structures in our world either allowed it to happen, provoked it to happen, caused it to happen, you know, whatever. The blame is still on their shoulders, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's, as far as opportunistic, I think it's a conglomeration of many different things that made this 9/11 happen. But I definitely think that the government took an opportunity. But then again, that is just my theory, no matter how conspiratorial that may come across. And John Paul, I think at this point we are bringing it to a close.
Well, we still have a couple of minutes.
I'd like to get off a little early.
You ready to turn it in now?
Yes, I am. Well, unless we have something to say, and say it.
I'll say my thank you, Claudio and John Paul, again for having me on the.
It's been great having you on, bud.
I really enjoyed this. Thanks very much
for coming. It was very enjoyable.
I just want to go ahead and plug my MySpace. If anyone
Good.
Is
okay, go for it.
Any young ladies in the listening audience that are curious about my music, they can reach me at myspace.com/.
You better get that right. Try that tongue twister again.
Backslash.
And here we Jorge, go again, backwards, folks.
myspace.com/Jorge3000. That's JORG300. And also, if anyone's just interested in performing my piece, I have the sheet music. It's handy, so.
Wonderful.
There you go.
All right, you budding pianists out there.
And in case anybody wants to tune into the speakeasy or is interested in being an underwriter or just to come on to communicate with us, my website is www.claudioarts, that's CLAUDIOARTS.com. And we'll see you at the speakeasy. Thanks for joining us, folks. This is Claudio signing off. Cheers.
Once again, a chill night wind blows its gales across the sea. As the sunset casts an inflamed and rippled hue across the waters. Vast distances of liquid motion stretch their infinity before me. And I have rarely felt so free. The sails are drawn for a night of rest. Where I go from here, the sea knows best. As the veils of night descend upon me, the moon emits its silvery canvas against a spectacle of aquatic celebration, as is only seen by night. The stars are scattered worlds of light against an opaque sky. and the nightfall is a constant whisper of the mysteries around me. Truly, all description would defy the beauty I choose herein to proclaim. Yet still, though encompassed by more wonder than many a man has e'er freed his soul to admire, my thoughts are adrift with the song of my heart, and the song of my heart with the voice of my soul. Adrift, 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 drifting ever back.